From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. When Margaret Seltzer put her pen to paper, she started writing about gang life in South Central Los Angeles. For 3 years, she worked with an editor getting the details of her story to flow on the page. We now know that her book, Love and Consequences, was a fantasy that she concocted. Like the fake memoirs before it, the revelation is sending shockwaves through the publishing world. Gilda Squire is the former director of publicity at Amistad Books, the African-American imprint of HarperCollins Publishing. She now owns Gilda Squire Media Relations, and she knows plenty about wrangling a memoir through the vetting process. Gilda, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
So what was your first reaction to hearing about all this?
Well, you know, it was disappointing because we just went through the whole James Frey controversy a couple of years ago. And so here we are again. And memoirs tend to be one of my more favorite book categories. I love delving into other people's lives and learning things about other cultures that I might not already know. So it's disappointing.
You edited Confessions of a Video Vixen by Corinne Steffens. We had her on the show. And It's a memoir about her life as a video dancer for artists like Jay-Z, R. Kelly, LL Cool J. It talks about hip-hop, sex, sexuality, family. Tell me about the process of getting her story to press.
Well, it's interesting. I'd heard quite a lot about Corinne via reading a magazine article about her and then hearing about her repeatedly on radio. And so when I reached out to her, I didn't really have a lot of expectations other than this might be interesting. And so I had a very long conversation with her. And, you know, upon talking to her, I was very impressed with her being very, her candor was amazing, first of all. And then secondly, the fact that she was unapologetic about her life. She wasn't proud of it necessarily, but she wasn't apologetic either. And so one of the things that we did, our editorial director, who is amazing, went out to LA and said, I just want to experience this woman for myself. And so she spent an evening with her in a popular Hollywood watering hole. And she knew after that evening that Corinne was who she said she was, just based on how people, particularly men, responded to her just from her walking into the room.
Well, that's one way of looking at things, but the publisher actually went a lot further to try to verify.
Oh, absolutely.
What else went on?
Once we turned in the actual manuscript and it was edited, went through a very lengthy legal due diligence process, and the lawyers were very, very diligent about, you know, not only making her produce receipts and arrest records, hospital records, but also, you know, talking to family members, friends from that period who could verify the stories in the book as well as others. So we were grateful for the process. It was long and it was frustrating. And at times we felt like things were being removed or, you know, revised to take away from it. But in the end, we were grateful because it really did result in no charges of fabrication.
Now, Seltzer reportedly gave her editors photographs of her foster siblings, a letter from a gang leader, introduced her agent to a woman who was supposedly one of her foster sisters. That sounds like not just a fabrication on the page, but a fabrication of a life. Could there have been a similar situation? I'm certainly not saying that Confessions of a Video Vixen is false, but what I'm saying is, could a dedicated person have faked anything?
You know, it's very unfortunate. This whole thing is very unfortunate. I think that having worked in the book publishing world and knowing how hard it can be to get a book deal and how difficult it is, especially when you're writing a memoir, to tell your story, it's not as easy as people think it is. You know, to think that someone would fabricate a story such as, you know, Love and Consequences, it, like I said, I can't find another word that's more appropriate than unfortunate. I think that this could have happened to anyone. You, as an editor, you have to have a certain level of trust between you and your author, and you're spending a good deal of time with them. You're reliving their story, parts of their story. There's an intimacy there that is indescribable. And so at the end of that, you want to be proud, just like the author, you want to be proud of what's published on the page. You believed enough in this book to purchase the rights to publish it. And so when that book is published, you're just as proud and as pleased and as honored as the author is. So I don't know any editor who would go into a process intentionally publishing something that they didn't think was true and worthy.
Do you think this is going to change the game in any way? I mean, there's, you know, one thing I think about with Confessions of a Video Vixen is that it was not published specifically as a street lit book, but it was crossover into, I'm sure, some of the buyers who buy street lit. And this book was a crossover in a way between kind of the gritty life story and the literary memoir, the one Seltzer's book, who, you know, Love and Consequences, which was faked. Mm-hmm. Is there something, especially as people show an appetite for grittier storytelling, is there going to be a a movement to try to figure out, well, are we being responsible in how we choose these stories?
I think the editors, sure, are going to be a lot more cautious. It's human nature to try to prevent the quote-unquote next time from ever happening again. Again, I don't know any editor who wants to see his or her name in print involved with something like this. Same thing with an imprint or a publishing house. But I do think that there's a possibility that a more formal fact-checking process might come into play. Publishing is a business, and just with any business that hits a bump in the road, if there's a possibility that that bump might affect their profitability, of course they're going to try to figure out how to adjust the process to make it so that this doesn't happen again, or at least try their best not to have it happen again.
Well, Gilda, thanks again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Gilda Squire is the former director of publicity at Amistad Books, the African-American imprint of HarperCollins Publishing. She is now the owner of Gilda Squire Media Relations, and she joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. We're now going to take this discussion of Margaret Seltzer and the news of the week to our reporters roundtable. Joining me now, Kevin Merida. He's the associate editor of The Washington Post and editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Also with us, Newsday columnist Cheryl McCarthy and Ernie Suggs. He's an urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, folks.
How are you?
Hey, Farai.
I'm doing great. Ernie, let me start with you. You heard us talking about Love and Consequences, this fake memoir.
Yes.
The publisher said that Seltzer provided evidence. And, you know, in this business, as a journalist, a lot of times we rely on books and previous material, books, documentaries,
sure,
TV
yeah.
shows. We all kind of bite off of each other. And so what responsibility do you have if you want to use a book or other research that other people have done to make sure that they actually represented what they were saying?
Well, I mean, you want to go to the credibility of the book and go to the credibility of the person. I doubt very many reporters would have used Margaret's book recently to do any kind of research. Anytime we use or I use a book in a story that I'm writing, it's from a credible writer, it's from a credible source. Everything that we do, everything that Kevin will tell you that we try to do, we try to get from credible sources.
But what do you mean by credible? What makes something or someone credible to you?
Well, I mean, you know the person. The person has a track record. I mean, I don't know this person. No one knows this Margaret Jones, or no one knew who she was. So someone that has a track record, someone that you may have talked to, you know, sometimes you just don't pick up a book and quote it. You know, if I want to write something about Kevin's book on Clarence Thomas, I will call Kevin and perhaps talk to him about that. But it's a matter of building a trust with that source. I think the important thing for all journalists to know and understand is the credibility of their sources. And if you don't have any kind of relationship with that book or that person, it's probably not a good idea to use it.
Kevin, have you ever been taken advantage of by a source, or has someone even tried it?
Well, I think that sources are—they're always, oftentimes, people have some angle of their own that they're pushing. And I recall doing a column once with about the issue of trafficking, human trafficking, and this was a very high level official at the State Department, and it was a worthwhile column to do. And she gave me some examples that then it turns out that she was using a pseudonym. And I was furious about it. I mean, I said that, you know, we can't use pseudonyms. I mean, you have to tell me that. I mean, I think that you're giving me an actual example. And I certainly didn't use it. But
mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't know, as Ernie says, you're taking the credibility of people that you have trusted or relied on. And you're using your own instincts to vet them and often. And, you know, it's a question of judgment a lot.
Cheryl, how do you make decisions about using acquired material or even just to influence you as you're looking around for story ideas? I mean, there are people who, you know, some people have compared this to any number, you know, Jason Blair scandal, other news scandals. And I do think that there's a difference between, you know, these news scandals and these literary scandals, but it's just a different venue. So how do you make sure that you're not getting the short end of the stick?
Well, you know, I probably have been had in the past and just didn't know about it. But, you know, you call up, you know, as Kevin said, as I think it was Ernie who said, you know, people that you trust. Sometimes it's PR people. Sometimes it's academic people. Sometimes it's people in politics. And, you know, ask them to recommend, you know, people who can speak to you with some intelligence on an issue. And that's usually the way I go. You know, if you're picking picking up a book like this one, you are assuming, you're in a tricky position, you're assuming that it's already been vetted by the editor and by the people at Random House, and that you can sort of, you know, assume that it's genuine. And often if you are writing a column quickly, you know, it's kind of hard to check around, you know, into her background and whether she went to the college she claims she did and whether she's from the family she's from. So that could make it tricky. And it's I think it could be easy to get deceived by a book.
So you think basically that, you know, there is a certain level of trust that journalists have about publishers, whether or not that trust is always warranted?
I do. And, you know, my reaction to this story was originally, boy, I wish writers would stop, you know, writing these scam memos. I mean, haven't they learned enough from the people who've been caught? If you want to write about gangbangers in the ghetto, I mean, you can write a credible nonfiction book. You just have to do a lot more work. And also, you know, I just sort of wonder, you know, where the editor was over 3 years and that she didn't catch on to this person's naivete. And you know what I think was at the bottom of it? Probably a certain typical thinking about the hood, about gangbangers and what it was like. So when she brought this, all these wild, over-the-top stories to the editor, this editor saying, oh, wow, did that really happen? And I think you probably got that from probably both of them, you know, from this person who's writing what she thinks is an authentic story about the hood and from the editor who thinks she's hearing an authentic story.
All right. Well, I have to break into the conversation now because it is a big one, but we have to take a break. Cheryl, Kevin, Ernie, stay with us. We're going to come back with more of our Reporters Roundtable. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back for more of our Reporters Roundtable. I'm with Kevin Merida of The Washington Post, Cheryl McCarthy of Newsday, and Ernie Suggs of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So let's move on to some political news. You've got Florida and Michigan. The delegates are on the chopping block. Some people are urging for the votes from these states to count. They don't count because the Democratic Party said, hey, you can't move up without our permission. And now the heads of the local parties, the state parties, are saying, well, what, are you going to disenfranchise us? So, you know, Kevin, I just wonder if Howard Dean is the unhappiest man in the world right now, because there's a lot of people. It's like, you know, going to a family picnic and going in with a bowl of candy and everybody's tugging at you saying, you know, more for me, more for me. What is he going to do about this?
Well, he's definitely on the hot seat. And, you know, I think that the train is heading toward seating the delegations. I mean, I think that they're going to figure out some way to seat the delegations, whether that's a so-called do-over election. And I think that's going to be a heavily negotiated process, whether or not, take for instance, Michigan has a caucus system. You know, there have been proposals to split the delegates based on the votes that counted. But I think that what he's going to do is assemble some party leaders, some of the elders, and really try to figure out something that seems equitable for all sides. You know, there are going to be people upset no matter what, Farai, because there are going to be some people who said that, you know, we had a process and we had a meeting. I talked to a super delegate the other day and said that if we don't follow our own rules, then they're not worth the price of the paper that they're written up on. So I think there's not going to be anybody happy, but I think the party doesn't want to take the chance of not seating two major states that are really swing states for the Democrats in the fall and take any chances of depressing turnout in the kind of close elections we've seen in the past two presidential contests.
Cheryl, I want to move us on to a different topic. Just this morning, Samantha Power, who was one of Barack Obama's top advisors, she wrote an award-winning book on genocide, resigned after calling rival Hillary Rodham Clinton a, quote, monster. This comment was apparently off the record, and it was told to a reporter at The Scotsman, but the Scottish newspaper printed it anyway. And was this an unethical move by the journalist or a bad mistake by Power or both?
Oh, I think it was a bad mistake by Power. You know, this is an election. It's hard fought. And if you're a journalist and you hear this kind of thing, you know, you can't not report it. But I think it just points up, you know, how you really have to, I hate to quote Ari Fleischer, but you have to watch what you say, you know, in these kinds of things. And it just sort of reverberated in a bad way, you know, onto back under Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Ernie, it reminds me a little bit in the broader sense of when Reverend Jackson made the Hymietown remark back in 84, referring to the Jewish population in New York. And it was also off the record, but it was also printed. Is there really ever anything that is really off the record?
Well, it goes to the rules that you set from the jump when you're talking to someone. There are several levels there. It's off the record. There's background. There's, deep background. But if you're just having a conversation with a reporter, I tell people, and every reporter can tell you, when you pick up a phone and call someone, a source, or meet someone face-to-face, they have to assume that it's on the record unless some ground rules have been set. As you know, I'm a member of NABJ, and on our listserv today, that's been the big topic. What's on the record?
NABJ, Black Journalists Association, and I am a proud member.
Of course, all of us.
I just want to point out for people who don't know what NABJ is.
But on our listserv today, that's a big discussion about what is on the record and what is off the record. And I agree with Ms. McCarthy. I think that the person it's a delicate situation. I mean, it's something that she shouldn't have said, but if the reporter feels that it was on the record and it was established early on that it was on the record, then anything you say can be used against you.
What does this mean, you think, Kevin? Right now, people always line up their dream teams of campaign advisors, and if you win, many of them go on to become, everything from cabinet members to staffers. All sides have some impressive advisors. What do you think this means, if anything, for the Obama campaign?
Well, I don't know that it means much in terms of that, whether or not, they lose a key advisor or not. I think that we're in such a close race that everybody's looking for an advantage. I suspect that the Clinton campaign will continue to pounce on this, and the attempt is to always try to have your challenger on the defensive. And if he's on the defensive trying to defend a remark by one of his advisors, then, she's going to try to make it seem like this says something about the candidate and the campaign. And in fact, Barack Obama is many miles away. He can't control everybody. But I think that in this period that we're in, where everything is so close, we're really in kind of a tactical fight right now.
I want to take a quick tour through another very big topic. In the Middle East, yesterday, 8 students were shot in a Jewish seminary in Jerusalem. One of the students killed was an American. It happened right after a visit from the U.S. Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, in which she urged Israel and the Palestinians to resume peace talks. Now, President Bush put on the table that this was going to be one of his legacy items, that he was going to try to broker peace. There's been huge fighting in Gaza, 120 Palestinians and 4 Israelis killed at the minimum. Where's the state of negotiations? I mean, Cheryl, do you have any sense that this is anything that the administration is really going to focus on, given that things are so desperate right now?
Well, I think they're trying to focus on it. And I think Condoleezza Rice, having blown it with the Iraq War, is looking for some, better legacy, of her stewardship of the State Department. But, I hear things like this, and, I almost don't know what to say about the Israelis and the Palestinians anymore. I remember when I thought that the Irish and the Brits were never going to have peace, and they've gone up to have it for a number of years, and the Palestinians and the Israelis are still at it. And it just seems to be, each side is always waiting for the other side to make the first move, to have the courage to, call off the dogs and say, we're going to give concessions, we're going to pull our people off, we're going to do the right thing. And it seems if you have people who've been warring with each other for decades and decades, nobody, their leaders are not willing to do that, then they're always pointing the finger at the other side, then you just aren't going to get to peace.
Ernie, what do you see coming out of this, specifically from the U.S. policy side?
Well, not much. I mean, there have been 130 people killed, 130 Palestinians killed since February 27th, I believe. And, President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have 10 months. They have 10 months to broker an agreement or broker peace. They have 10 months to get us out of Iraq. The United States government right now has a very small window in which to try to make a significant difference in the Middle East. And I just don't think that this administration at this particular time, considering the escalation that's happened recently, is going to make that much of a difference.
Kevin?
Well, no, I don't see that. I mean, I think that there's so many things on the plate. The economy is really the number one issue that's driving American interests, and I think that that's going to really, really consume this administration, and they're going to be trying to figure out how to deal with that in conjunction with their soon-to-be nominee, John McCain.
Well, I want to thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Cheryl McCarthy, a columnist for Newsday. She joined us from our studio in New York. Kevin Merida, associate editor for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from the studios at The Washington Post. And Ernie Suggs, urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Depression, paranoia, schizophrenia, they're seen as scary words and even more frightening realities. Does our fear of even talking about mental illness keep us and those around us from getting help? African Americans in the U.S. facing mental health issues aren't very likely to get therapy or medical support. We continue our month-long series on mental health with a look at the ways Black communities are getting over the stigma of therapy. Joining our conversation, Janice Sanchez. She's a psychology professor at Old Dominion University and the author of The First Session with African Americans, A Step-by-Step Guide, and Laverne Williams, a community outreach educator for the Mental Health Association in New Jersey and a deaconess at Union Baptist Church in Montclair, New Jersey. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me start with you, Janice. A lot of Black folks aren't very likely to get medical help for mental illness or therapeutic help. Can you tell me what are the roots of the distrust?
Sure. There's a great deal of stigma attached with seeking mental health services for African Americans. It takes a long time before they're willing to acknowledge that they have a problem. And typically, once they acknowledge the problem, they do not want to go for formal help. They will sometimes talk to their minister and they will get advice. And one of the things that's helped me in my practice is when we have ministers who actually encourage clients to seek out psychological services. I think people really feel that there's something wrong with them. And there's really this attitude of we don't want to air dirty laundry to the wider public. There's a sense of shame about talking about psychological problems.
Laverne, some people say that they just hold on through church, through prayer, through other spiritual practices. How important has that been? And is there any downside to people's reliance on you know, religion? That's a very touchy question in some ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. A lot of times, unless you admit that you have a problem, you cannot get any healing. And so going to your pastor and or the clergy person, if they have not had psychological training, they could be doing you a disservice. And so that's why the Pews program is helping pastors and lay clergy identify persons in their congregations who may be at risk of or have a psychological problem to be able to refer them to the proper services in the community.
You mentioned the group that you founded, Promoting Emotional Wellness and Spirituality, Pews, but what do you actually do?
It's in three parts, actually. The first step is to acknowledge that a faith community would like to have a presentation, and we start with a video and a PowerPoint presentation, and the video was entitled Anything But Crazy, African American Spirituality and Emotional Wellness. And we sort of meet people where they are. We start with grassroots myths that are out there and try to see what people have been brought up to believe. After that, the second time we come back into that faith community, we bring professionals with us because we want professionals to feel comfortable with what is happening in some of our faith communities, but also for the faith communities to see that perhaps the psychiatrist or psychologist is not the big bad boogeyman. And then the third step, we tailor information based on what the congregation wants. For example, some persons have more elderly in it, so we may talk about elderly and depression. Some congregations may have more single parenting. So it depends on what that congregation wants.
You came to this work because of, an experience in your own family. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I'm the last of eight children, so I'm from a very large family. And the girls were very close. And my second sister who passed away, when she was having, she had a terminal illness and she just was in denial through the whole process. And because I wasn't able to talk to her about it, I started internalizing it so much that I started having panic attacks and depression. I know I would be riding down the parkway, and unfortunately, my hands would shake, and I would break out in a cold sweat, and I knew that it was not normal, but I couldn't stop myself. Because I work for the Mental Health Association, I knew that I should seek some help, but I didn't really know who to go to because there's not a lot of African Americans in this field. And for me, actually, I went to a phone book, and I ended up looking at a psychologist's name. Her last name was the same as mine, Williams. So I called her up. She told me she was Caucasian and that I have a problem with that. But at that point, I just wanted to feel better. So I went to see her, and it worked out very well for me. But I know a lot of times the issue in the Black community is that people want to go to someone who looks like them and who they feel will understand their culture.
Janice, your book really deals head on with this. It's called The First Session with African Americans. And it sounds like it's targeting people who will be therapists for Black Americans, whether or not those therapists are actually Black. Is that what you're doing?
Well, basically, this book is really designed to help capture the experience. It's for therapists, and it's for clients, it's for educators. But the important message is really just what your guest said, is that we really believe that African Americans can receive help from a variety of therapists of different ethnic backgrounds. But we really point out why it might be important for them to be very adamant about asking if there's an African-American therapist that is available. We think that the reason why African-Americans come for help vary. I live in the Hampton Roads area. We have a lot of military individuals, and they do have insurance coverage. But there are many communities where people don't have insurance. And typically, we find that African-Americans try to struggle with their problems. They don't want to ask for help, but many people get to the point where they have to ask for help. It may be a case their child is having educational problems and may be retained. It may be relationship problems. It may be the loss of a job. It may be violence. It may be drug abuse. But, you know, African Americans have problems the same way that other populations do. But because of various economic factors, because of the alienation that we receive from our communities, many African Americans feel very alone, and it's very difficult for them to ask for help. So what we try to do is to make sure they know that there are African American therapists, or they can ask for an African American therapist to find out if the therapist can help them with their presenting problems.
So you think that it's really better, easier, more seamless of a transition to work if you're a Black person with a Black therapist?
I would say that it really depends upon the individual. I think for many people, it's going to be very important to have a client who looks like you. There's some individuals that I've worked with who did not want to have an African-American therapist because they have been brainwashed to believe that if someone's African-American, they don't have the same credentials, they're not as intelligent, they're not going to be able to provide the same quality of services. So we have some individuals who only want to see Black therapists. There's some individuals who don't want to see a Black therapist. And there are a lot of people who are ambivalent. And I just take the perspective in a first session to lay out to the individual. I ask them to tell me what's happening, what their concern is. We chart out a possible plan for intervention. And then I leave it to the client to decide if I'm the right therapist that they would like to work with, or if they are not comfortable, I'm happy to make a referral.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're continuing our conversation about African Americans and therapy. It's part of our month-long series on mental health, and with me is Janice Sanchez. She's a psychology professor at Old Dominion University, and Laverne Williams, an associate and a community outreach educator for the Mental Health Association in New Jersey. So welcome back. And, you know, Janice, let me just dig a little deeper into this whole issue of Black person, Black therapist, white therapist. It sounds like, as with everything, it's complicated. Everything having to do with race is complicated.
Yes. Yes.
How do you walk into a room and make an evaluation as a client of whether or not someone understands you, not just in a general sense, but also culturally?
I think that if I'm a client coming to therapy, the most important thing is that the therapist understands who I really am. And I think that clients have different opinions about their racial identification. For some individuals, when they come for therapy, their race is very much tied to the particular problem. As Mrs. Williams says, sometimes your race may not be. You may be struggling with depression, or you may be struggling with anxiety, or you may have a work situation in which your race doesn't really have an impact on the therapy. So the first thing that I think a client has to be clear on is they need to understand their sense of identity and whether or not it requires having a therapist of their background. I think if you're coming for a child, if you're coming for a partner, if you're coming for a situation that you don't think is really tied to your ethnic identity, then I think it's fine to have a different therapist. You might be coming because there's an emergency. When there's an emergency, where there's some sort of a crisis situation, you really don't care about the race. You just want to get help. But I think if you're talking about getting in touch with who you are, if you're talking about an issue in terms of relationships, I think that your race may be very salient. And I think that individuals who are dealing with relationship issues, for instance, they really might want to have a therapist who understands their cultural background, who understands what it's been like to be African American. And even when I use that term, I'm talking about so many different people. Some identify as Black, some as African American. So I think it really depends upon what you think about yourself and how you want to communicate that to the therapist in terms of how much focus you want to spend on your ethnic identity.
Laverne, you made a decision to go to someone who wasn't Black, but what this all calls up is, what does it really mean for someone to understand you? In some ways, a therapeutic relationship is really about, does this person understand me? Or, you know, if you are a client or, you know, if you're trying to advise someone else to get help, it's like, are you being heard? And how did you make a decision about whether or not you were being heard?
The panic attacks was coming so fast and furious, I didn't care who it was. You could have been purple. Just give me the help that I needed. And I'm just so excited to hear that Sanchez is really doing assessing persons in the African-American community, because, again, it's just about awareness. When I think about 15 years ago, when HIV/AIDS was, everyone was afraid of that issue. With education and with training, people are now able to hug someone who has AIDS and go visit them in hospitals without any problems. And that's the same thing about mental illness. Until we start getting the word out, which the Mental Health Association does, and letting people feel comfortable about it, I like to say that mental illness is not a casserole disease. If someone had a heart attack, or they have diabetes, or if they have cancer, people will flock over their houses with casserole and, oh, what can I do to help you? When you say mental illness, people just back up, and it's all about education. And the last thing I do before I leave here, though this side of the world, I'm going to make sure awareness is raised, and particularly in the African-American community. The only shame is not getting help.
When you think about the people you've helped, Laverne, help connect with professionals, with support, what are you most proud of?
I am most proud that people can come to me and really talk about the issues that they have. And, for example, when I do a presentation at a faith community, I can almost spot somebody in the room who I know is maybe battling with something, whether it's for themselves or a loved one, and they may not say too much during the presentation, but they will come up afterwards and give me their phone number or ask for more information. And if they have to do it on the side and where they think others aren't watching or hearing, that's fine because they're asking for it. And so now I can't tell you how many persons in my faith communities have come up with me and shared problems and directing them that they'll be able to talk about it without the shame and the stigma involved. I just think that's wonderful.
Janice, should you go into therapy if you choose to go into therapy with a game plan like, okay, I'm fighting with my husband. I want the fights to end. I want to decide if, you know, I should do this, this, and this. I mean, is it about really practical things? Because there's this whole idea of Freudian analysis as you lie back on the couch and talk about your childhood until you expire.
Right.
You know, what are we really talking about?
I think most therapists today are very solution-focused therapists. It's very helpful for an individual to come into therapy and to say, this is the problem, this is where we're at, I'm not comfortable, I want to make some changes, and I'm here for you to help with that process. So I think that if you have a good conceptualization as to what your concern is, I think it's going to help the therapy to go even faster. I think that psychoanalysis is still available and that there may be individuals who have the time to really delve deeper into one aspect of their personality. But I think most African Americans that I see are really very focused on having a very specific problem when they come in. And many of them really think it's like going to a doctor's office, that they'll come in and in that first session, I'll lay out for them how the problem can be resolved. So I think that my job is to, you know, to speak on the radio, to speak live, but to let people know that there are places where they can go to get help with their problems. But I tell them that usually they're going to need to come for more than one session. We know that 40% of all individuals who come for therapy never return for another session. And African Americans, that's even higher. So one of the things I try to communicate is that we're here, we're able to help. we just need you to come in and talk. And I try to take away the stigma that there's not a stigma associated with coming for mental health. It's like going to the doctor. It's like going to get any other kind of help. You would not stop if you were having some sort of a physical crisis. And we try to explain to people if you're having an emotional or psychological problem, it's very normal for you to come and see us.
All right. Well, Janice, Laverne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Janice Sanchez is the author of The First Session with African Americans, A Step-by-Step Guide, and she's a professor of psychology at Old Dominion University. She joined me from member station WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia. And Laverne Williams is a community outreach educator for the Mental Health Association in New Jersey and a deaconess at Union Baptist Church in Montclair, New Jersey. She joined me from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Her work has been called revolting and shameless. Critics have even suggested boycotting her shows, but Kara Walker's stunning, controversial black and white silhouettes have earned her international acclaim and a MacArthur Genius Grant. The 39-year-old artist has shown her work at some of America's finest art museums. Walker's art takes a deep dive into issues around slavery, sex, and liberation. Even her most refined pieces have a deep rawness that begs for explanation. Kara Walker just opened a huge show at the University of California, Los Angeles. It's not too far from our NPR West studios, so I headed over to talk with the artist herself. But before we go on, a quick warning. This piece has topics that will offend some listeners. So we're here in Los Angeles's Hammer Museum, and I'm facing an enormous semicircular painting by Kara Walker, and luckily we have her with us today to talk about her award-winning work. How you doing?
I'm pretty well, thanks.
So the exhibit is called My Compliment, My Enemy, My Oppressor, My Love. What does that mean?
Well, the title actually comes from this piece on the wall. It's called Letter from a Black Girl. It's a 50-foot long wall, and there are a number of figures marching along this wall doing various things. They're cut from black paper and adhered to the wall with kind of wax adhesive. And starting on the left, if we wanted to read it narratively, is a hoop-skirted bell and a soldier, hands entwined, leaning toward one another in a kiss. Underneath the hoop skirt of the woman, a pair of legs jutting out. What I was interested in doing was kind of exploring the terrain of romantic, racist kind of stereotypes and archetypes.
Well, you have plenty of taboos. You have a figure that I certainly read as black, a girl with pigtails sucking the privates of what looks like a white boy. You have a male figure, which I read as black, with an enormous penis inflated to the size of a helium balloon. A lot of your work has sexual, scatological themes, and it strikes me as angry. Do you think of it as angry?
I think of it as giddy. I think using the silhouette is kind of a device that maybe is a little bit cagey.
And the silhouette has a long history as this, you know, courtly form of women wearing these cameos, and as well as the silhouette used as a form of portraiture, and it comes out of this history where you're not going to see the sexual and scatological. I mean, how did you decide to combine this giddiness and anger with this really almost prissy format?
Well, that's just who I am. Prissy little girl.
So I want you to lead us around in a second and see some of your work, because you have worked in a lot of formats, but I want to bring up something, which is that some African Americans, including some artists, seem really discomforted by your work, and there's definitely a lot going on. In 1999, the artist Betty Saar was in a PBS documentary series, and she said, "I felt the work of Kara Walker was sort of revolting and negative and a form of betrayal to the slaves, particularly women and children, and that it was basically for the amusement and the investment of the white art establishment." That's like a big knife out for you. What do you think? I mean, what did you think when you first heard that or saw it on the television?
I think the first thing that's kind of striking to me is that I'm not making work about reality. I'm making work about images. You know, I'm making work about fictions that have been handed down to me. And I'm interested in those fictions because I'm an artist, and any sort of attempt at getting at the truth of a thing, you kind of have to wade through these levels of fictions, and that's where the work is coming from.
Well, speaking of where we are, can we just walk around with you a little bit and maybe talk about a little bit more of your work?
Yeah.
So there's so much in this exhibit. It's really magnificent and scary. And this is one of the pieces that you're known for, Darkytown Rebellion. More silhouettes, but also you've got a backdrop of projections. What's this piece about?
This is maybe the second or third projection piece that I made, and I started working with these overhead projectors to kind of set a stage, I guess, for the silhouettes. I was flipping through a sort of a historical book of it was called American Primitives, American Primitive Painting, unschooled artists from the 19th century, and there was a very strange black and white reproduction of a painting that this is a copy of. It had these stereotypical sort of black figures marching through it. But I liked the layout of it because it was so quirky as a landscape. So I just did a quick study of the landscape and I took all the people out. And after that, I thought, well, where did they go? and the piece was called Darkytown, so I thought I would just add some of the figures, a jockey and some kind of a rebel, and then it spirals downhill from there to unidentifiable figures.
Well, I want to bring in Gary Garrels. He's the curator here and brought your work in, so let's go track him down.
All right.
We found you, Gary, right outside of the exhibit hall. How you doing?
I'm good.
So why'd you bring this exhibit here, and what's your relationship?
Well, I was one of the lucky people to have seen Kara's show in New York at the Drawing Center in 1994 and was blown away by it, as were so many people, and followed the work and had the good fortune to have Kara come out and do a show with me when I was at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in 1997. So when the Walker Arts Center decided to organize this retrospective, Ann Philbin, the director, and I both thought, this has to come to the Hammer Museum. This is the only place on the West Coast it's being shown. Our first Hammer Project, which is our series of exhibitions with young artists, usually at a pretty early point in their career. Kara initiated that series here in 1999, so there's a lot of history here.
When you think about the footprint that this could leave in time and how people might look at this, 150 years from now, roughly as many years as we are from the antebellum era, what do you think they'll think of this?
You know, I think the most that I could hope for is that 150 years from now, some kind of, maybe shy amateur historian is going through the archives somewhere and stumbles across an image that I've made, and that image resonates. Because the most fascinating thing for me is to look at older art, to look at, say, a Goya and think, oh, there's just something so intensely human. There's something so kind of charged and terrifying about this experience of being alive. And that's actually, where the whole art-making impulse comes from for me, so I would hope for that.
Kara, Gary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kara Walker's new exhibition, My Compliment, My Enemy, My Oppressor, My Love, opens this week at the Hammer Museum at the University of California, Los Angeles. And Gary Garrels is the Hammer's chief curator and the museum's deputy director of exhibitions and public programs. And there's more about Kara Walker, including some of her silhouettes and a clip from her puppet films, at our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.